First, good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Steele, Justice Berger. May it please the court, Adam Wendett for the appellant, Theodore Norman. Seated to my left at the table is my co-counsel, Chuck Whitehurst. In this appeal, the appellant has raised two issues. The first related to an alleged Brady violation. The second is regarding the trial judge's decision to permit multiple police officers to testify as lay witnesses identifying alleged illegal substances under the court's holding in Wright. I'd first like to address the appellant's Brady arguments. There are two components to the Brady argument. The first dealing with the source of the prosecution's knowledge or the allegation that the appellant's window was open only 6 to 8 inches and that Mr. Smith was standing upright at the time he was shot. The second Brady argument deals with the nature of the evidence itself and the allegation that in and of itself that evidence is exculpatory. I'd first like to address the
first tell me anyway, if not us, what is the material that the state knew that it didn't disclose?
The material that the state knew that it did not disclose was presented for the first time in opening statements. That information was that the appellant's car window was 6 to 8 inches open, only partially open. The second piece of information is that Mr. Smith, the alleged victim, was standing upright at the time he was shot.
On the 6 to 8 inches, as I understand the actual testimony, no state's witness testified that the window was 6 to 8 inches open. Is that correct?
I don't believe that they used the term 6 to 8 inches. Mr. Cawley did reference, however,
halfway down.
Excuse me?
Something like halfway down?
I believe at trial he did visually reference the window being down and gestured an amount. And that amount was approximately 6 to 8 inches, although he didn't say precisely 6 to 8 inches.
Now, how do we know, to the extent the difference between halfway down and 6 to 8 inches or a representation by counsel for the state that it was 6 to 8 inches, how do we look at a record and determine that he made this gesture from the stand that's consistent with 6 to 8 inches? What is the material that the state had before trial began that should have been disclosed to you because it was exculpatory, that is, in fact, inconsistent with the case that the state presented? What piece of paper, what note of oral statements to the police, what videotape, what audio tape, where does that information that you knew or should have known about because it would have affected the way in which you presented your case or affected the outcome, what tangible evidence do we have of that?
Well, I think it could be inferred from the state's presentation of the case that there was an additional statement made by Cawley, Raymond Rosa, or both of them prior to trial. The defense was provided.
But the state says there is no such thing. Where do we go on the record to confirm that you're right, that the inference is a sound, logical inference? Or that the state is wrong because when they say it doesn't exist, it in fact exists. How do we deal with that? Brady arguments generally are based on actual tangible evidence that existed and the state unilaterally determined that it wouldn't be exculpatory, therefore they didn't disclose it. But yet it pops up at trial and suddenly the defense is surprised because they would have tailored their case differently, or it may have made a difference in the outcome had they known about it beforehand.
Yes.
And it's rarely a dispute over whether a tangible piece of evidence exists or not, particularly when what you've just related to us is that the prosecutor's statement that 6 to 8 inches was consistent with some hand sign that their witnesses made at trial. And what are we left with? The difference between the significance of 6 to 8 inches open window and halfway down? Is that all this is about?
No, Your Honor. It's not, because it goes further than that. The fact that you had no testimony or no statements by Rosa or Cawley after the incident to the police officers regarding the height of the window. Then at trial, both Cawley and Rosa testified that the window was only open enough to see Mr. Norman's face, the gesture that it was only open a certain amount. In the presentation of Cawley and Rosa at trial regarding the height of the window, I think it's clear that there was some type of statement made at some point to the prosecution regarding the height of the window opening. Whether it had been an oral statement or a written statement, I think that it could their only logical conclusion that could be come to based on the state's presentation of the case and the evidence is that some statement was made prior to trial.
All right. If there were such a statement, how would it be exculpatory?
Well, it would be exculpatory in two respects. First, there was a pretrial motion filed, a Brady motion filed by the defense that was granted by the trial judge as to Justin Cawley's statements to Delaware State police officers. He made two inconsistent statements immediately after the incident. Now, because he testified at trial regarding the height of the window and the state presented in its opening statement statements regarding the height of the window in Smith's posture, logic suggests that a statement was made to the prosecution by either Cawley or Rosa prior to the time of trial, an additional statement. Since there was already the ruling on the defense's Brady motion, it follows that if Cawley made an additional statement, it would have to be inconsistent with one of the first two statements. Therefore, that's the first prong of Brady, that it's impeachment material.
Well, wait a second. I've lost you. Let's assume that there was some sort of pretrial discussion about what Cawley was going to testify about. And going through the facts, Cawley said, yeah, the window was open roughly eight inches. Why would that necessarily be inconsistent with his two earlier statements?
Well, if you give two statements and those two statements are inconsistent, any subsequent statement have to be inconsistent to some degree, unless it only provided additional information.
Right. If you've got one statement that says, here's what happened, another statement says, here's a different version of what happened, and a third statement, if you will, that says, here's what happened, and the window was open this amount. If that was not something that was focused on in either of the prior statements, or if he always said it was open that much in the prior statements, then you've got no inconsistencies.
Well, the defense was in possession of two of Cawley's prior statements. They were ordered by the trial judge to be
And they gave no
disclosed.
Reference to windows,
and,
did they?
And neither one of them gave a reference to windows. Now, for the third statement to not be inconsistent with the first two, it could only deal with additional information. If it deal with any of the subjects that were discussed in the prior two statements, there would be some inconsistencies. While the height of the window may not be an inconsistency, it would be a logical assumption that there would be some inconsistencies in the third statement if he had to talk about anything he spoke about in his first two statements.
So if I understand your argument, you're saying that you believe there must be a third statement, although the state says there isn't.
Yes.
And that in that third statement, there would be exculpatory information because it would have to prove that he had given one more inconsistent statement.
Yes.
Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes. And also...
Well, let me make sure I understand that. For Brady material, doesn't have to be both impeaching and exculpatory.
Yes.
Is your argument, because you never answered my question about why it was exculpatory, but you're talking about inconsistent statements that could have been used to impeach witnesses. Are you limiting your Brady argument to the impeachment theory?
No, I was about to address the exculpatory nature of the evidence.
Okay.
Now, as to the exculpatory nature of the evidence regarding the window height and Smith's posture, first, I don't think there's any argument as to one prong of Brady that the material was not disclosed to the defense. The defense was never informed about the window opening.
Unless the material didn't exist.
Yes, unless the material didn't exist. I just wanted to address that prong. As to the other two prongs of Brady, the first being that the material itself was exculpatory. Now, given the state's presentation of the case and the evidence from Cawley and Rosa regarding the window being closed most of the way, open 6 to 8 inches or possibly more if that's how you want to view it, in any event, if the defense had been aware that the window was alleged to have been closed that far and that Smith was alleged to have been standing straight up, expert testimony could have been acquired recreating the shot. Also, GSR evidence could have been acquired to eliminate some different possibilities with the shot. Now, if scientific evidence could have been obtained to rebut the state's theory of the case and to rebut the testimony of Cawley and Rosa, that would be exculpatory evidence, and I'll explain why.
Well, in doing that, can you also respond to the state's position in its brief that there's no justification for shooting someone that punches you?
Well, Your Honor, the Brady argument that I'm making regarding the exculpatory nature of the evidence, it flows in some steps, so I just ask that you allow me to go through a couple of the steps, and it may take a little time, but I will try to be as brief as possible. If scientific evidence could have been obtained that the shot could not have occurred in the way Cawley and Rosa explained it, you've attacked the credibility of those two witnesses. You can show that their statements regarding the window height and Smith's posture are inaccurate, are a physical impossibility. Now, if you have two witnesses that testify to the same facts in a case, you know, that's not entirely rare. But if you have two witnesses that testify to the same facts, and those facts are later proven to be a physical impossibility, that's exculpatory because it raises some inferences. How do two eyewitnesses, both testify to the same thing, and that event is physically impossible? It suggests collaboration of the witnesses. It suggests that neither one of the witnesses are credible. Now, both of those witnesses were the witnesses who informed police officers and testified that Smith was unarmed. So if you can present evidence to prove that the shot could not have occurred in the way they testified, and you impeach their credibility, and they're both shown to be telling the same story, which is a physical impossibility, then it would follow that you can't believe a whole lot of what they're saying.
Well, that can be impeaching, but Justice Holland's point, I think, is if ultimately there's no dispute that your client fired a shot and it killed someone, and his justification defense was based on the fact, I shot the guy because he punched me, how is it exculpatory if the law doesn't justify taking a gun to a fistfight?
Because Cawley and Rosa were the sources of evidence or information that Smith was unarmed. And if you raise into question the entirety of their testimony and you raise the inference that there's a collaborative effort to change the facts and to testify in a way that distorts the facts, that raises a question of whether Smith was unarmed or not.
What other evidence is there that he was armed? Is this just disputing a negative?
Well, when we look at the justification defense, the subjective and objective components of a self-defense claim, Mr. Smith was found to have an object in his hand. It was a bag of alleged marijuana. He did punch Mr. Norman in the face. So Mr. Norman was in a dark area at night on a side street. He was just punched in the face, and he saw Smith with an object in his hand. I think that objectively and subjectively, if you impeach those witnesses, you consider the object in his hand, the assault.
Subjectively, did he testify that he believed that Smith was armed?
No, Mr. Norman did not testify.
Well, then where is the evidence to support that subjective or objective view that he had reason to believe that Smith may have been armed that would justify firing a shot and killing him?
It's circumstantial.
Well, okay. What are the facts that raise the circumstantial evidence?
Circumstantial evidence that Smith was armed?
Yeah.
The inaccuracies in the physical impossibility and Cawley and Rose's testimony, the incredible nature of their testimony, the fact that Smith was found with an object in his hand, that it was dark outside, I think subjectively anyone in Mr. Norman's position could feel that Mr. Smith was armed. He also had two gentlemen flanking him on each side. So it's unclear if Mr. Norman would have been able to see everything that was going on and whether they were armed.
Okay.
Now, I'd briefly just like to address the second argument raised on appeal, and that is that the trial judge abused the discretion in permitting multiple police officers to testify as lay witnesses regarding the identity of alleged illegal substances.
How many counts of the indictment does that touch, if we were to rule in your favor on that respect?
I believe two, the drug charges. Two or three, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Well, is it fair to say however many drug counts there are, it would touch on all of those?
Yes, I believe, except for the delivery charge, because again, he could still be convicted for delivery of a counterfeit substance, even if there was no testimony that it was marijuana.
Okay.
Now, I will be very brief on this argument because I think the opening brief speaks for itself, and the appellant's previous argument speaks for itself. And all I will say is that it sets a dangerous precedent to allow the state to not comply with the court's scheduling order, the rules of the court regarding discovery, designation of expert witnesses, and pretrial disclosures, allow them to disregard any pretrial orders and allow them to circumvent rules and substitute reliable scientific evidence with unreliable evidence that's veiled as expert testimony. There's an extra indicia of reliability when you have police officers testify as the identity of substances. And essentially there's no incentive for the state in the future to comply with those orders if they know that if they don't comply, they can submit evidence, introduce evidence that's less reliable with an extra indicia of reliability.
You're down to a minute and a half. Do you want to save your time?
I'll reserve that.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. May it please the court. I'll address the two arguments in the order. They're set forth in the brief. The first argument concerned...
Can I interrupt you right at the beginning and just ask, can you explain how it is that the state was presenting a case saying that the window was only partway down when apparently that was never the subject of prior discussions with these witnesses, and yet there was no further statement given by any of these witnesses? How does that work? What's the logical explanation?
Well, I guess the logical explanation is if you shoot somebody and you're in a car, you either shot through the window or the window was partially down or all the way down. That's what happened here. There was a photograph, I believe, that was introduced at trial of Mr. Norman's car that shows there's no damage to the window or the car from a bullet passing through that. So I think... The testimony from the various individuals, there's three eyewitnesses here. Two people are outside the car, Mr. Cawley and Mr. Rosa, and then there's a third individual, Terrence Robbins, who is actually a front seat passenger in Mr. Norman's car. They all testify that to some extent, nobody's real specific in terms of measurements, that the window is down.
Right. I understand about the testimony at trial.
Right.
I think that opposing counsel is raising an issue about the fact that you got up or the state got up in its opening and said, here's what you're going to hear. The window was, you know, partway down or 6 inches down or whatever.
Right.
And opposing counsel is saying, how'd you know that? It's one thing if you found out by asking a witness on the stand and he tells you that, but you knew it walking into the trial. Well, who gave you a statement that gave you that information?
Hmm. Well, what the state had, there were statements from each of these three eyewitnesses. There was also a second statement from Justin Cawley, who was the first trial witness, and what that was the camera and recording device in one of the state police cars was running. This is on the night of the shooting. And Mr. Cawley is making statements in response to the police officer asking some general questions about what had happened. So there's two of those statements. I think there's actually a very short third statement of some sort. It's the text of the 911 call that Mr. Cawley made, and that was introduced. But in those statements, the witnesses describe what happens. Now, I don't recall if anybody says specifically about the windows being up or down.
Justice Berger's question is a little more straightforward. What's your understanding of the basis for the statement in the opening to the jury of 6 to 8 inches? What's the source of information for the prosecutor saying that?
Well, I think the source is that there's no indication that there was damage to the car window, and the person was shot. We know that from the autopsy.
But the prosecutor picked 6 to 8 rather than saying, you're going to hear testimony that the window was open.
Yeah.
That isn't what was said. It was said 6 to 8. So, I guess it relates to the more, even more specific question. I'm sure you've talked to the trial deputies. Did Justin Cawley give a third or fourth statement that said 6 to 8 prior to trial, or did he say that during an interview prior to trial?
No, he didn't. I talked to both the trial prosecutors, and there's also a question that occurs on the, I guess it's the fourth day of trial. It's not in the appendices, but it's in volume D of the trial transcript at page 74, and it's a cross-examination question by the defense of Detective Mark Papale. He's the chief investigating officer, and the exchange, very briefly, I'll just read it, says, the question from defense counsel, and do you recall who it was that told you the window was rolled down? And the answer, which vehicle? Question, in Theo's vehicle, I'm sorry. And the answer is, that's okay. Raymond Rosa informed me he spoke, they were speaking through the window, so I was assuming that the window was rolled down. This is Officer Papale. And I believe Justin Cawley advised Detective Porter of that as well. The next question is, but nobody said before they came into court here it was only down 6 or 8 inches. Is that correct? And Detective Papali's answer is, not specifically that I can remember, you're right. So the police officer says he doesn't remember anybody saying 6 to 8 inches. Now, the source of the 6 to 8 inches, this specific reference, as best I can find, I read the opening statement of this state, and what they say is that the window is partway down. They don't say 6 to 8 inches. In direct examination, Mr. Cawley does not say 6 to 8 inches. What he does, what Justin Cawley does say, he says is that the window is partially open and that you can see Mr. Norman's face. I think he gestures and says you can see from like the chin up, or it's represented that you can see from the chin up. Where the 6 to 8 inches, those specific numbers first occur, looks like to me, the first reference I can find anyway, it's also not in the appendix, but it's volume A, and it's at page 102, and it's a question from defense counsel on cross-examination of Mr. Cawley. And the question by defense counsel to Mr. Cawley is, he had the window about 6 to 8 inches open, and then his answer is, yeah. And the question is that what you said? And the answer is, yes, sir. So that's the first reference that I see where anybody specifically says 6 to 8 inches, but it's not a trial witness. It's defense counsel that's characterizing it. Now, presumably, what defense counsel's doing is basing this 6 to 8 inches reference on the estimate, the visual estimate that Mr. Cawley testified to on direct when he said, well, it's down about this far, and he gestures.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned there was a photograph of the car. Does the photograph show the window down partway?
I don't know if it's down or up. I'm sorry. All I know is that there's a photograph of the car, the window, and there's no apparent damage to the window or the car.
If we then were to follow what we heard in the opening argument, that the prosecutor did in fact say 6 to 8 inches in his opening, that would be incorrect. You've read the opening statement, and the prosecutor said partially down.
It says partially down. It says a little way down, I think is his exact words. I think it's at A58 of the appendix. It says the defendant rolls his window down a little bit. That's what he says. Okay. And the first time I see anybody specifically saying 6 to 8 inches is actually a defense cross-examination question of the first trial witness, Justin Cawley, where he says, is it 6 to 8 inches? And Mr. Cawley agrees that, yeah, that seems reasonable. I think he says, yeah.
Okay,
that's the response.
The problem I'm having is this. A shooting took place from inside a car to somebody outside the car, right?
Correct.
And it would seem that almost anybody who's giving a statement about what happened would mention somehow, was the window open or closed or partway open? And yet what you're telling me is that every statement the state ever obtained talked about the shooting and what happened before and so on, but nobody ever gave any information about whether the window was all the way open, closed, or partway open.
I don't think anybody specifically says that. What they say is they're talking to Mr. Norman. They want their money back. They want the $60 back. They think they were sold substandard product. So there's conversation going on, and I guess the assumption is, well, if you're going to talk to somebody, you do that. And I think somebody says he rolls the window down, but he doesn't say how far. I can't remember exactly which one says that. But Mr. Cawley goes up first and tries to talk to him, and then Mr. Rose is there. And I think Cawley's testimony is that he and Rose are leaning forward in the window, and they can see Mr. Norman's face from the chin up.
But that's the trial testimony.
Yes.
That's not from a prior statement.
Right. And I think the prior statements is that they're also talking to him, but I don't remember anything specifically about how far the window's open or if it's open or closed. Well,
were there pretrial statements that indicated, consistent with, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce the first name correctly, Nikki Cawley and Robbins, that Smith actually reached into the car and punched Norman? Was that part of any statement they made pretrial that would clearly be inconsistent with the window being closed? It would have to be at least as far down for a fist to go into the car. Were those statements recorded in a way and then disclosed before trial?
I don't recall if that's addressed or not. I know the trial testimony from Rosa and Cawley is that they didn't see him punch him. And then,
well, they're two Cawleys.
Yeah, excuse me, Justin Cawley and Raymond Rosa. They're the ones standing outside next to the victim, and both those individuals testify at trial that they did not see William Smith strike Mr. Norman.
Well,
but the other two say that there was a punch.
Yeah, they're not surprisingly, that many people, it's logical you're going to get inconsistent recollections of what happened. But it's it was clear if any statement by Nakia, Cawley, and Robbins was disclosed before trial that at least two state witnesses believed the window was far enough down for someone to punch Norman through, presumably, an open window.
Oh, I think that's true.
So are we down to the issue of how far open it was? So there, if it's 6 to 8 inches, it tends to negate a justification defense if there is one based upon a punch. But if it's halfway down, a punch could have occurred. If it's all the way down, it's clear a punch could have occurred. I'm trying to get the significance mm-hmm. to 6 or 8 inches as opposed to partially down, as opposed to halfway down, all of which seems to have been testified to at some point by somebody.
Right. I think the significance, at least from the defense point of view, was that they wanted to limit the extent that the window's down, and that's why the defense question is an attempt to characterize it in quantitative terms, 6 to 8 inches.
Well, and my inference is the exact opposite, that the defense would have wanted the window as far down as possible because it would have demonstrated there could be a punch that would have justified under the circumstances of a drug deal at night with three persons standing outside the car, could have justified a subjective, reasonable fear of danger that would justify a shot and speeding away after the shot. Maybe that just shows how people look at facts differently, but I would have thought this defense was troubled by the suggestion that the window was only down 6 or 8 inches because that's inconsistent with anybody being able to deliver an actual punch, and that where did the state come up with 6 to 8 inches when they had witnesses testifying, at least two, that would testify there was a punch through an open window?
Well, Terrence Robbins certainly says that Mr. Smith punched Mr. Norman before the shot was fired. There's no doubt about that. The closing argument that the defense gives, they kind of talk about both things. They talk about the justification in terms of the person being punched, but there's also several references in the defense closing argument to the 6 to 8 inches and the difficulty in trying to shoot out that small a space. So I guess both were really being argued, although seemingly there's some contradiction. If your defense was justification, then that was the argument that he was acting in self-defense, and the judge, I think, very generously allowed that to go to the jury. That was what the defense was really arguing. There wasn't a total denial that a shot had been fired or that some phantom shooter had actually shot Mr. Smith. The question was just whether or not he was justified in firing a shot after being punched in the face. That was the sum total of the defense argument, I think, here.
Are you going to address the second issue?
Yes, I can certainly turn to the second issue. Here's
my concern about the second issue. Having participated in the Wright case, I'm concerned about how far that ruling, if it even applies to this case, how far that holding should be taken. What is the significance of the Wright case in terms of allowing police officers, I don't know if you want to call them lay witnesses or modified experts, testifying that a substance is or is not a dangerous drug?
Well, I think probably you have to limit it to the facts here. And here we're just talking about marijuana. Wright was dealing with cocaine, and the individual who gave the lay testimony was the person who had supplied the cocaine to Mr. Wright and was, in fact, I guess, a cocaine dealer himself. One of the cases that's cited in Wright is the Seventh Circuit decision, I think, in Dominguez, and it also references law enforcement officials. So I think law enforcement officials, if they have the appropriate experience, may be able to offer lay testimony identifying at least some contraband drugs. Now, the difficulty, I guess, for a police officer is whether they could really tell if a white powder was or wasn't cocaine, but marijuana seems to be more of a popularly recognized drug. So I think here the judge was on a firm ground in allowing that lay testimony limited to that extent. The thing about Wright was that the drugs weren't available for testing. Here the drugs actually were tested, and it was determined that it all was marijuana. The reason that the, I guess, more reliable or expert testimony, the scientific forensic chemical analysis, wasn't allowed in was that the state was not able to get that testing done at the ME's office prior to the discovery cutoff date, and the state had not asked that the discovery cutoff date in December be extended. At least some of the drugs, some of the marijuana, there were three different seizures, was delivered to the ME's office in July of 2007. Unfortunately, because the way things were backed up at the ME's office at that time, the state did not get the report until a week before trial, but the report did confirm that it was all marijuana. The trial judge on defense motion shortly before trial said, well, you didn't comply with the discovery cutoff deadline. You didn't ask for an extension, so I'm going to exclude the expert forensic chemist in that particular case. So I think,
and the defense argument is that if we don't circumscribe right, that there's going to be no need for the state to ever send drugs to the medical examiner again. They'll just simply call the police officer.
Well, I think they certainly could call the police officer if the officer has sufficient experience, but I think given the nature of these different drugs that it's probably going to be pretty hard in any case other than perhaps marijuana to do that. The difficulty, I guess, is what do you do when you can't present expert testimony that you have? Is there any other way to present it? And that's the dilemma the state had in this case, so they allowed the police officers to testify.
What did the trial judge rely on, the Wright case or a finding after listening to the police officers testify that they had sufficient expertise to testify as experts rather than lay witnesses on this material being marijuana? What was the basis for the trial judges allowing it in?
Well, I think it may have been both. That one of the prosecutors actually was aware of the Wright decision, even though it had come down, I think, the month before this trial, and did cite that to the trial judge. So the trial judge was certainly made aware of the Wright decision. The second thing, I think, was that at least two witnesses had already testified and identified one of the seizures as being marijuana before there was actually a defense objection. So some of it had already come in. Now, I believe the marijuana seized at the house and the marijuana that was seized from Mr. Norman's person a month later had not yet been identified. So that was what the focus really was at that point. The trial judge did ask for some additional questions, I believe, of Detective Daddio about his experience, but it wasn't the kind of examination you would use to qualify someone as an expert. I think it was simply to show that they had experience sufficient to offer a lay opinion. So I think it was really two bases, the right decision and the trial testimony of Officer Daddio about his experience. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those.
Along those lines, is it fair to say it's one thing for a police officer who has throughout his career found marijuana plants growing in a field, knows what they look like, know generally what they, if they have an odor, what they smell like, and then had confirmed over the years that what he found turned out to be marijuana, identified this to be a marijuana plant? Is that something different than a substance that's ground that arguably is oregano or marijuana or basil leaves or whatever? Is that the same kind of lay testimony that should be allowed in these circumstances?
Well, I think it is, and it's going to depend, obviously, on what the circumstance is. What is the substance? And, you know, we've had all kinds of cases where people thought they were buying powdered cocaine and bought baking soda or something else.
Yeah, well, that would be my question here. Right. You brought this up earlier, and it actually raised the question in my mind. Did this substance look like a granular substance or a vegetable substance just sort of ground up in a little bag, or was it a plant that's clearly distinguishable from an orchid or something else?
Mm-hmm.
Why is cocaine powder different than a granular substance that looks like marijuana that could be oregano, could be basil leaves, or my favorite, ground okra, some vegetable plant?
I guess it just depends on the physical characteristics. Here, the whole dispute in this thing arose because the marijuana that was delivered was supposed to be not what passes in the street. It was brown in color as opposed, I guess, to being green, and it had sticks and stems in it, and it wasn't a green leafy substance, I think is the way it usually gets described.
Consumer fraud is what we're dealing with.
We're definitely dealing with gross consumer fraud here. That was the allegation, and that's what precipitated the shooting. But that's where I guess in the future the lines have to be drawn, is what is it you're talking about? Would a police officer, given certain experience, be able to identify something like that or not, or is that just too far afield?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly to address the court's request for a reference in the record regarding Cawley's gesture regarding the height that the window was open. In trial transcript at A67, the prosecutor asked for the record to reflect that Mr. Cawley gestured that the window opening was from the chin up, from the chin to the top of the head. So that would quantify that measurement. Also, as to the court's request about the subjective belief of Mr. Norman that would have justified the use of deadly force, Mr. Smith and his Mr. Cawley, Mr. Rosa, and Mrs. Cawley followed Mr. Norman for 4 miles from the Hamlet Shopping Center. Also, when Smith was at Mr. Norman's car window, he stated, and it's reflected in the record, that he knew where Mr. Norman lived, that he made threatening statements regarding the fact that he knew where Mr. Norman lived. Also, as to the height of the window and why it's an important piece of evidence, it not only goes to the justification defense, but it also rebuts the premeditation argument and the state's argument in closing that Mr. Norman had to raise his gun to fire the gun. That is all, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to recess.